getting to know the FRW metric and gradually adding more and more physics. And the idea is we're supposed to be getting closer and closer to a realistic picture of our actual universe. And so that process, you know, we want to continue today. So the scheduled topic for today is sort of thermodynamics / statistical mechanics in FRW spacetimes. Because, well, so we'll see a lot of important physics enters here. But first, in terms of, I just wanted to finish off the getting to know the Friedman Robertson Walker lecture, the sort of lecture notes 5 and 6, part 3 of that. So remember, in the first part of those lectures, the getting to know FRW lecture yesterday, we learned about the geodesics that massive and massless particles follow. And again, we said the key point is that their spatial momentum redshifts as one upon the scale factor. So as the universe expands, the momentum dilutes. And for massive particles, this is Hubble drag or Hubble friction. They come to rest with respect to the co-moving observers as the universe expands. With massless particles, this accounts for the redshift of those particles. Their wavelength stretches in proportion to the growing scale factor. And then we met the horizons. And I think the basic takeaway point is that there's a distinction between future horizons and past horizons. And future horizons are sometimes known as event horizons, whereas past horizons are sometimes known as particle horizons. So these guys represent a limit on how far away you can send signals to the future. And so in particular, universes that are expanding and accelerating, so they have the second derivative of the scale factor with respect to time is positive, have event horizons. Universes that are decelerating have past particle horizons, limits to how far away the observer, there's some limit on how far away he can have received a signal from. Yeah?
Well, I see how the two phenomena are different, but why call one event and the other particle?
That's a good question. I don't have an answer. This is just terminology. If you want, I kind of like this guy better because it has a clear meaning. You'll just hear people sometimes refer to this guy as the event horizon, and this guy as the particle horizon. This is sort of the particle horizon because the idea is that in decelerating historically, it was thought that the universe had been that the Big Bang model had been decelerating throughout its evolution, even though now we think that it's recently started accelerating, and also hypothetically it had a period of accelerated expansion far in the past. But when it was thought to be decelerating all of the time, this particle horizon. The past horizon, the maximum distance that you could see, co-moving distance that you could see, was very similar to the maximum distance from which you actually received physical particles, the CMB photons. So I think maybe that's the historical origin of that name, but I think it's just a matter of terminology. So now in yesterday's tutorial, you had a chance to look a little bit at the dynamics, basically solving the Friedman equation and the continuity equation. So I just wanted to make a few comments here to close off that topic to sort of complement what you did in the tutorial. Okay. So for starters, again, to remind you, what you derive on the homework, the n-dimensional Friedman, the n plus one dimensional Friedman equation, looks like this. And the n-dimensional continuity equation looks like this. And so the first thing is if we simplify to the case where n is equal to 3, this guy becomes comes like this, and this guy becomes like this. Now, the next thing that I just want to mention is that something about the cosmological constant and the energy of reinterpreting it as vacuum energy. Basically, I want to, from now on, sweep this term into here. So I'm going to define rho vacuum to be lambda over 8 pi g, and then I'll just define rho total. I'll just include rho vacuum as a part of rho total. So I'll take what I was previously calling rho, and I'll add rho vacuum to that, so that this equation just has looks a bit simpler. Okay, no longer has the cosmological constant term. Okay, now why do we call it the vacuum energy? Why did I call this thing the vacuum energy? Well, that's really what it is. It's indistinguishable from that. So to see that, you know, remember that the action for Einstein gravity coupled to matter looks like then there's the gravitational part. And then the matter Lagrangian. Okay, so let's just focus on the simplest matter Lagrangian, the Lagrangian for a single scalar field. Okay, so in that case, what we have here is the kinetic term for the scalar field and its potential term. Okay, so now in this Lagrangian, this 2 lambda over 16 pi g term is just a constant. And, you know, any constant here I could just imagine reinterpreting as just an extra constant in the definition of V of phi. Like it's just ambiguous. If I have some constant in the action, how much of that constant should I put into lambda, and how much of it should I put into an overall constant in V of phi? There's no unambiguous way to divide that up. So without loss of generality, I can just reinterpret all of this constant as contributing to V of phi. So in other words, if I originally had a V of phi that looked like this, but I also had some positive cosmological constant lambda, I could just reinterpret that as a new potential that looked like this. With the exact same action, I could just write it as with lambda equals zero there, but the overall potential lifted up by an amount lambda over 8 pi g. Okay, and so the vacuum, the energy of the vacuum, the lowest energy configuration of the field, has been lifted up by that amount. Okay? Yeah?
So it looks like originally, before we start considering lambda as part of the potential, we include lambda in the kinetic terms.
We include it in sort of the the way Einstein originally thought of it, it was kind of part of the gravity action.
Okay. But I was wondering why it was there in the first place.
Well, so Einstein was just trying to write down you know, Einstein didn't start from the action. He was just trying to write down an equation that had T mu nu on the right-hand side and then some terms on the left-hand side that were consistent, that were covariant, that transformed, that made the equation covariant, so these guys transformed under coordinate transformation like these guys did. And then they also had to satisfy another consistency condition, which is this side is divergenceless. So these terms had better be divergenceless. And he figured out there's basically two terms you can write down. There's a G mu nu term that has the same indices and is divergenceless. And there's a G mu nu term that also has the same indices and is divergenceless. And lambda, for him, was just the proportionality constant that went in front of G mu nu here. So to him, it looked like this was the gravity part. This was the gravity side of the equation. This was the matter side of the equation. And so, yeah, he just wasn't thinking about it in terms of actions back then. I think that's the basic reason. So now the next thing. So from now on, we'll write the Friedman equation in this form here. So now, if we look at that equation. If k is equal to 0 in the case where the universe is flat, okay, so basically the dynamics of that equation are, well, k is just a constant. It's plus or minus 1 or 0. And whatever it is, it doesn't change with time. It's just, so if the universe is closed, k equals plus 1, if it's spatially a 3-sphere, it just remains a 3-sphere forever. That doesn't change. Or if it's spatially open, a hyperboloid, it just remains a hyperboloid forever. If it's a flat Euclidean 3-space, it remains that for all time. So an important relationship is the relationship between, you know, notice that if you set k is equal to 0, if you take the flat case, then there's a particular prescribed relationship between the energy density at a given time and the expansion rate at a given time. If I just set k equal to 0 in this equation and solve for rho, I find that rho is equal to 3 h squared over 8 pi g. Newton. And this is true, this is then true at all times in a flat universe. Okay, so this formula for the density, this is a special, this is called the critical density in an FRW universe. It's the, so for if the universe at some time is expanding at some rate, there's a natural sort of preferred, I don't know, but there's a natural critical density, which is given by 3h squared over 8 pi g. So stated another way, if you measure the expansion rate and you go out and then measure the density of stuff in the universe at that time, if it's more than this critical density, 3h squared over 8 pi g, you know that your universe is closed up into a sphere. If it's less, it's open, it's negatively curved, and if it's exactly equal, then you've determined that your universe is spatially flat according to general relativity. Okay, and you know, this is particularly important because our universe again appears to have exactly the critical density to the best that we can determine. So today, the density in our universe appears to be, you know, we roughly speaking, we can just measure the expansion rate of the universe today, compute this quantity, and then in various ways go out and measure the density today. And indeed, it turns out that the density today is equal to the critical density, plus or minus, you know, we have that measurement with 1% accuracy. And so that's, you know, why. That's called the flatness puzzle. So as far as we can tell, throughout the whole evolution of the universe, the density has always been equal to the critical density to very good accuracy, to the best accuracy that we can determine. That's called the flatness puzzle. I'll mention a bit more about that later. There's sort of more to the flatness puzzle, which is that as you look later and later in the universe, it's arguably more and more surprising that the universe still looks accurately flat. So the fact that it looks this way today, 14 billion years after the Big Bang, when 14 billion years is like stupendous relative to any other sort of fundamental time scale in physics, exacerbates this problem. I'll explain that more in a little bit. Okay, So the next thing, as you guys showed in the tutorial, you know, you solved this equation. So the continuity equation, you took the case, the special case where P is equal to just a constant times rho. That particular relationship between that particular form for the so-called equation of state. This W is the so-called equation of state parameter. And you showed that solving this equation, the solution is that rho is proportional to A to the minus 3, 1 plus W. Okay, so in other words, when W is bigger, in other words, when the fluid that fills the universe is stiffer, right? Bigger W means bigger pressure for a given density. So you have a certain density, you try to compress it and it resists more strongly. So the stiffer the equation of state, the more positive W is, the more rapidly the energy density dilutes. Okay, that's what that equation is saying. This, if W is bigger, this exponent is more negative. So when the universe expands by a certain factor, that corresponding energy density dilutes faster. So I just want to say that there's a, you know, so you just derived that, so you know it's true, but there's another simple physical picture about what's going on there that's worth understanding. So again, if this is my picture, I always draw the spatially closed universe. So this is really just the statement of the first law of thermodynamics in an expanding universe. So the first law of thermodynamics, I remind you, says that if you have some gas or fluid in a box, it's basically conservation of energy. So the form in which you'll usually meet it in thermodynamics class for the first time is like this. So that the change in energy in the box is equal to TdS, the amount of heat that you add to the box, minus PdV, minus the work that the pressure of the gas in the box does on the walls as you change the volume of the box. Okay, so in an expanding universe, we'll discuss this later, but this is this perfect fluid, its entropy is staying constant. We're not adding or taking away any heat from the gas. But we have these two guys. What box do we want to consider? Well, let's just draw with our marker a little box on our balloon, and watch that box expand as we blow up the balloon, as the universe expands. Okay, so let's say that box has volume V, so physical volume V. So V grows with time. V is proportional to A cubed. Well, the energy in the box is the energy density in the box times the volume of the box. So this is d of rho V is equal to minus P dV. So this guy is rho dV plus V d rho, just expanding that out. And then that's just expanding out the left side. Expanding out the right side, well, P is just W rho, so that's minus W rho dV. So collecting the d rho terms on this side, I have V d rho. Collecting the dV terms on this side, I have minus 1 plus W rho dV. Let me divide by V and rho to just bring the rho over to this side and the V over to this side. So this becomes d rho over rho is equal to minus 1 plus W dV over V. And again, if I just integrate this thing, this says log rho is equal to minus 1 plus W log V. And now I exponent plus a constant. Now I exponentiate that, and that says that rho is proportional to V to the minus 1 plus W, which is a cubed to the minus 1 plus w. V is proportional to a cubed. I mean, V is a three-dimensional box, so it, spatial box, so it grows in proportion to the cube of the scale factor. So this is a to the minus 3, 1 plus w. Okay? So anyway, just to say that this is a physically sensible answer, that's the physical interpretation of it. So then I wanted to mention there are three very important cases, the three cases that sort of come up, if you want, most commonly in actual questions about our own universe. There's W equals zero. This is a non-relativistic matter. So this is the equation of state of a gas of particles where the particles have kinetic energies that are very small relative to their rest mass energy. W is equal to 1/3. So this is relativistic matter, radiation. Like a gas of photons. And then W is equal to minus 1. So this is dark energy or vacuum energy. Okay, and so now again, I'd just like to give quickly a quick physical picture to so you can see why these are the right equations of state parameters for these three phases of matter. So let's talk first about non-relativistic matter. So if we return to our picture of the universe, we've drawn a little marker. We've drawn a box with our marker on the balloon. Now we imagine filling this box with a gas of non-relativistic particles. So what's going to happen to the energy density here? Well, the energy density is the energy, total energy in the box divided by the volume of the box. The total energy in the box, well, it's not changing as the universe expands because it's the energy of each particle is dominated by its rest mass, which is just a constant as the universe expands. Okay, it's rest mass plus kinetic energy, and its kinetic energy may be being diluted away as the universe expands by Hubble friction, but it's negligible. It's totally dominated by its rest mass. So the total energy in the box basically stays constant, but the volume of the box goes up as a cubed. So the energy divided by the volume will be proportional to a to the minus 3. And if you compare that to our formula, a to the minus 3, 1 plus w, you know that says that w is equal to 0. Okay? So check. We understand that one. Okay, time for a break. I just realized I forgot. I'm at risk of forgetting a joke two lectures in a row, which would be unacceptable. So, in fact, rightfully, you guys deserve two this lecture. So there are three people stranded on a desert island, a Frenchman, a German, and a man from Odessa, the home city of the jokes that you guys have shown that you like the best. They're fishing. They need to get food somehow. They're fishing, and they've been there for a long time. But one day, you know, usually they just catch fish, but this day they catch the golden fish, the golden fish of wisdom. And the golden fish gets reeled in and says, you know, please don't eat me. If you just spare me, I'll grant each of you a wish. And so they're thrilled. And so the Frenchman says, you know, my wish is just to be back in France with a bottle of the finest, just off this island, back in France with a bottle of the finest French wine. And poof, he's back. He's back in France. And the German says, "That sounds great. My wish is to be back in my home city of Munich with a mug of the finest German beer." And poof, he's gone as well. And the guy from Odessa looks around him and he goes, "Oh, we were just getting to know each other. I just wish my friends were back." Anyway. By the Odessa joke standards, this one fared reasonably well. It did. Okay. Why did I do that? So, how about that? This isn't going to work either. It did work. Did work. Okay. So, now we want to get relativistic matter. You know what? I should have just kept it the way it was before. I apologize. Okay. So now, suppose that instead of a gas of non-relativistic particles, we have a gas of photons here. So now, again, we count up the total energy in the box. Well, each photon has energy h bar omega, its frequency. But now, as opposed to these guys, just the energy density of each particle in the non-relativistic case was just its mass, mc squared. But here it's h bar omega. So now the total energy in the box, well, each particle's omega goes down as 1 over a. It redshifts proportional to 1 over a. So the total energy in the box goes down as 1 over a. And then in addition, the volume of the box increases in proportion to a cubed. So the energy over the volume is proportional to a to the minus 4. It's the a to the 3 dilution that we had up here, plus an additional factor of a from the fact that each photon's energy is going down proportional to a. And again, if we compare that to our formula, we see that it means w is equal to 1/3. Okay? So this guy also checks out. To see that the equation of state of dark energy is vacuum energy, in other words, the cosmological constant lambda, if you want, to see that that is W equals minus 1, well, we can see that in two different ways. One is that if you just look at that expression for rho vacuum at the top there, it's just a constant. Okay, and so again, if we interpret that with our formula a to the minus 3, 1 plus w, you know, we want this to be a to the 0. We want it to be a constant, independent of a. So that says that w is equal to minus 1. Another way to say it is that if you look at Einstein's equations, you know, if you want to pull this term over to this side and interpret it as we know that we saw in a previous lecture that the stress energy tensor for a perfect fluid is P times G mu nu plus P plus rho U mu U nu. But we see here that our vacuum energy is proportional to just g mu nu. It just has this term here. This term goes away. So again, you want p to be equal to minus rho, so that this term will cancel. So in other words, w is equal to minus 1. And then comparing, we find that p is equal to minus lambda over 8 pi g, and then that's equal to minus rho. So that's p vacuum, rho vacuum. So we recover the same formula for rho vacuum. Okay, so that's enough about that. Those cases are all important. Our actual universe appears to contain those three cases. okay, so now another thing is that I don't know if you had a chance to derive it in tutorial. It sounds like my understanding is most people did not. I'm not going to derive it here. If you want, it's a good exercise. I explain in the notes in the lecture notes for lectures 5 and 6 how to derive it. But you know, just for if you just want to solve the Friedman equation, for a general equation of state W, so P is equal to W rho, and for a general curvature K is equal to +1, -1, or 0, you can do so. You can find the general solution exactly, and I'll just say that so the solution has this form that to solve for it you have to work in terms that switch to the conformal time eta, and it's equal to some constant which you can derive times S sub K to the alpha of eta over alpha. It's equal to this nice simple expression where K is the curvature, alpha, the exponent here, is 2 over 1 plus 3W. And S sub K of alpha, I mean S sub K of X, remember that's the same function that we introduced when we were switching from the radial coordinate R to the other conventional radial coordinate chi. So S sub X is this function that's equal to sine of X when K is equal to +1, X when K is equal to 1, when K is equal to 0, and sinh of X when K is equal to -1. So it's just, you know, here you can just see it might be worth drawing for yourself. It's sort of fun to do. To check what are the possible behaviors of this sort of simplest type of universe. So you know, you'll find that depending on whether alpha is positive or negative, and depending on whether K is positive or negative or 0, and depending on whether eta runs, well, accordingly, depending on whether eta is positive or negative, you just get a simple catalog of all the possible behaviors that a universe with just one energy component like this can have. So it can do things like, you know, in some cases the universe will expand and recontract in a finite time. In some cases it'll just expand from a Big Bang to infinite size. In other cases it'll contract from infinite size and then bounce and re-expand to infinite size. In other cases it'll contract from infinite size to a Big Bang. Okay. Now, because our own universe is observed to be flat, k equals 0, to the best that we can measure, it's worth saying a few more words about that case. Okay, so in that case, as you showed hopefully in tutorial yesterday, when you solve the Friedman equation, you find that the scale factor is proportional to t to the 2 over 1 plus W, or you can write it in terms of eta. It's proportional to eta to the 2 over 1 plus 3W. So first of all, you see that this is that in this case, you know, the behavior is always t either runs from minus infinity to 0 or from 0 to infinity. And correspondingly, the scale factor either contracts from infinity, from infinite size, the universe either contracts from infinite size down to zero size, down to a big crunch, or it expands from a big bang up to infinite size. H, which is A dot over A, and if you just calculate the time derivative of this divided by this, It's given by 2 over 3, 1 plus W, T. So in other words, at any given time in a flat universe, the rate of expansion is related to the time since the Big Bang by some proportionality constant. Okay, so for example, until recently, and you know, they're inversely proportional to one another. So as the universe gets older, it expands more and more slowly. And so if you measure how slowly the universe is expanding at some given time in a flat universe, you're measuring how old it is. Okay, so the story is not quite this simple because our universe does not have just one component. But roughly speaking, for most of its history, the universe has been matter-dominated. It has been dominated by non-relativistic matter, as I'll explain more in a minute. W equals zero. And so this ratio is just 2/3. And so you could go out and measure the Hubble expansion rate today, and then you know, 2/3 divided by the Hubble expansion rate today is the age of the universe. You can calculate the age of the universe today, and you get something like 10 billion years old, which is roughly speaking right. For a while, it was actually a problem because you would do that. People thought the universe was matter dominated today, was really still dominated by non-relativistic matter. They did this calculation. They calculated the age of the universe. They got something like, I forget, 9 or 10 billion years old. But then they would look out in the sky and they would actually find stars that were older than that. So that was puzzling. They found stars that were 11 billion years old or 12 billion years old. So that for a while was a big puzzle that ultimately got resolved when, that was one of the many puzzles that got resolved when, well, now it's a new puzzle, but it's a new, even deeper puzzle. But so we now think that there is a component that recently, just recently in cosmic history, the universe stopped being dominated by non-relativistic matter and started being dominated by vacuum energy. That turns out to modify this formula in such a way as to make the universe a little bit older for the observed expansion rate. So the universe now is very, very accurately measured to be 13.7 billion years old, which is comfortably accommodates all of the oldest observed stars. But okay. And then the last thing I just wanted to mention was, so I said the flatness puzzle is why is the universe flat? Period. I mean, that's the simplest statement of the flatness puzzle. Why is the energy density of the universe today precisely equal to the critical density? An even sharper statement of the puzzle is usually given, which is sort of time dependent. So you look at the Friedman equation, and it looks like 8 pi g over 3 rho minus k over a squared, okay? And the fact that the energy density of the universe today is equal to the critical density plus or minus 1% says that the sum of these when you sum up these two terms, you get an answer, and this term contributes 100% of that answer plus or minus 1%. This term, if it contributes at all, it's less than 1%. It's less than 1% of this term today. Maybe much less. But anyway, the error bars we have are just plus or minus 1%. Okay, and the problem is just that neglecting the fact that recently dark energy has started to dominate, because that turns out to be irrelevant, or as far as we know, irrelevant to this question. For the vast majority of the universe's expansion, from roughly 1 second after the Big Bang until the present, 14 billion years after the Big Bang, many, many, many decades of expansion of the scale factor, rho here has been either the energy density of the universe has been either dominated by radiation, which dilutes as a to the minus 4, or non-relativistic matter, which dilutes as a to the minus 3. So, but in either case, this term, as the universe has been expanding, this term has been dropping faster than this term. So So the question is, if this term is more than 100 times bigger than this term today, then you know if the critical density is within 1% of the if the density is within 1% of the critical density today, that is to say, this makes less than a 1% contribution today, then in the past, it was the density was equal to the critical density to much greater accuracy. So if we look back to the time of Big Bang nucleosynthesis, which is when we have our first solid test of the Big Bang model, the scale factor was roughly a billion times smaller than it is today. The universe was roughly a billion times smaller. The volume was a billion times cubed, smaller. Then this term was stupendously bigger than this term, according to GR. So in other words, the density was equal to the critical density to some fantastically accurate extent. And the question is just why? What set the initial conditions to be so close to the critical density? Okay, and again, I'm kind of trying to lay out a bunch of the basic puzzles about that the universe presents us with. There is by now a common answer in cosmology. Let's say it's become the conventional opinion. At the moment, the most successful answer to all of these questions is the theory of inflation in the early universe. And so we'll at a later lecture we'll see how it claims to address all of these problems. But it's also important to stress that is on much more speculative footing than the things we'll say about the subsequent expansion of the universe between 1 second and today. So it's worth just seeing the puzzles and thinking about whether, in many cases, it's quite conceivable that there could be other explanations for what's going on. Before moving on to thermodynamics and statistical mechanics, I just wanted to draw a picture. We're now sort of ready to give a first sketch of how the universe evolved. What is the current picture given to us by data of the history of the universe? So let me make a sketch of log of rho versus log of A, log of the scale factor. So at early times, there's very good evidence that the universe was dominated by radiation, by relativistic matter. And as we saw, radiation dilutes away as the universe expands, proportional to A to the minus 4. So there's some line with slope minus 4 here, which is the radiation in the universe. But then there's also non-relativistic matter. There are also massive particles in the universe. And at some point, they only dilute as A to the minus 3. So they dilute more slowly. So at some point, they overtook the radiation and then there is apparently, disturbingly, irritatingly, this other component, which observations indicate, which appears to be well modeled by saying that there's yet a third component of the energy density in the universe, that is vacuum, behaves like vacuum energy, may just be the energy of the vacuum, and it scales as A to the 0, so it's just a constant. So this is usually called vacuum energy, or the cosmological constant, or dark energy. Yep.
What did you mean by it acts like vacuum energy?
So you know a host of experimental data about cosmology, which I'll be in a better position to explain later in the course. In order to fit them, it's not enough to include just these two components of the matter in the universe. You have to add a different component, and you have to have it scale as a to the zero, approximately. It appears to have to scale, like, its energy density has to scale as a to the zero plus or minus 0.1. So within 10%, its evolution is consistent. To the best that we can measure, its evolution is consistent with the evolution that you would predict for the energy of the vacuum, wherever that went. It's behind the board here, but the W equals minus one vacuum energy evolution, where rho scales as a to the zero, where it's just given by lambda over 8 pi g. It's just a constant. That appears to be the type of matter that you have to add to get the expansion of the universe to fit a variety of observational data. Did I see a hand? Yeah.
So the behavior is scales with a constant k0, but why should that scaling with a constant be characteristic of vacuum energy?
So the statement was what we mean by. Where did my picture go? Did I erase it? I think maybe I erased it. By vacuum energy, I just mean the effect of taking a constant and adding it to the potential to the potential energy of the rest of the fields in the universe. So in other words, instead of having, if I just lift this guy up by a constant, this is saying that now if the fields lie in their lowest energy state, instead of having energy zero, they have some new energy density rho vacuum. And this thing just is a constant. In this picture, this is just V of phi, the scale factor of the size of the universe doesn't enter into the picture. This is just V as a function of the value of the matter fields. So it's a constant that bears no relation to A. So now if we look at this picture, this era where the radiation was the dominant component is called the radiation-dominated era. This era where matter dominated is not surprisingly called the matter-dominated era. This final era that we appear to have just entered is called the dark energy-dominated era. The transition, you know, this transition point, this moment in cosmic history when the two components crossed, would be called matter dark energy equality. And this point where radiation and matter crossed would be called matter radiation equality. So to put some scales to things, if you really assume that these are the only three components in the universe, and you extrapolate back, then at some point in the past, the universe A shrunk to zero. So A is getting smaller and smaller. At some point, A reaches zero. That happened at some finite time. In this model, that happened at some finite time in the past that you can calculate. It's about 13.7 billion years ago. Okay, let's say about here. Okay, so this is PSI Cosmo Review. That's the standard lingo you'll hear cosmologists use to refer to this epoch. So that's about 14 billion years. After the putative Big Bang, It's a bit of a puzzle why we there's two puzzles which are known as the two cosmological constant puzzles or the two cosmological constant puzzles. One of those puzzles is just why this vacuum energy is so small. You may or may not have heard in your quantum field theory course that this is a huge embarrassment for quantum field theory. They predict that this vacuum, that, you know, the naive expectation is that this vacuum energy density should not be what we observe, which is an extremely ultra-tiny energy density that only begins to be felt on the largest cosmological scales. That, you know, it should be, they predict it should be something 120 orders of magnitude bigger than this. Something many orders of magnitude bigger than this, depending on what you think is the right UV cutoff scale on the quantum field theory that you're using to calculate it. But then the second aspect of the cosmological constant problem is just why now? Why does it happen to be that we live so close to the transition to the transition between matter and dark energy domination? You know, if we had lived just a little bit earlier in cosmic history, dark energy would have been subdominant. We probably never would have noticed that it was there. If we had lived a little bit later, dark energy would have been so dominant that it would have caused the universe to accelerate and diluted everything away. And a little while later, we wouldn't be able to see any of our neighboring galaxies. And again, we would have a very hard time learning this picture of the universe. So what's going on? Why are we? It seems a little bit fishy that we happen to be living at just the right time to get the whole picture. A couple of other that's 14 billion years. Let's mark the other most important events to take away from this course. The events that you should really know about in cosmic history. So first of all, matter radiation equality, that happened when the universe was about a few thousand times smaller, when the scale factor, so A today over A at matter radiation equality is a few thousand. The universe, the distances between everything were a few thousand times smaller when that transition occurred. Shortly after that, when the universe was about 1,000 times smaller than it is today, there was an event that was when the cosmic microwave background photons were released. Okay, so what do I mean by that? So we'll see that as the energy density of the matter and radiation dilute, their temperature goes down as well. So at very early times here, not only were the matter and radiation at very high energy density, they were at very high temperature. They were at such high temperature that neutral atoms couldn't form. The temperature was so high that thermodynamically it was much more favorable for the protons and electrons in an atom to be stripped apart into separate constituents as opposed to forming neutral atoms. And the universe cooled and cooled and cooled and cooled until suddenly, at a rather sharply defined moment in cosmic history, it became thermodynamically favorable for electrons and protons to bind up together into neutral atoms. So suddenly when that happened, think of it, you know, try to think of this from a photon's perspective. You know, have a little, you know, try to get, you know, you guys always looking at it from your perspective. What about the photon's perspective? So from a photon's perspective, prior to this moment, he had like tons of, photons love to bump into charged particles. Prior to this moment, they had like tons of charged particles to bump into. They had everything they wanted in life, and so they were just happily bumping into protons and electrons, mainly electrons, not going anywhere. They didn't have to. They just kind of sat around and bumped into their neighbors, and they had a happy existence. Suddenly, it's like, you know, all the protons and electrons got together and formed atoms, and like the poor photons, what are they left with? Nothing. It's just a bunch of neutral particles. They have nothing to run into, and so they just They just suddenly, they don't talk to anybody. They just go streaming across the universe. The remaining 14 billion years are very lonely. All they do is the universe expands, and they stretch, and they move to lower and lower energies. And then finally today, a tiny fraction of them happen to fall onto our microwave telescopes, and we observe them as the bath of cosmic microwave background radiation around the that fills the universe today. So in other words, today if you look out with a microwave telescope at the sky, as was discovered in the 1960s, the sky is actually bright in microwaves. It's full of any direction you point your telescope in, you see virtually the same thing, which is namely a Planck, a thermal equilibrium distribution of photons with a temperature today. So the temperature of the CMB today is about 3 degrees above absolute zero. So in other words, and as we'll see, that what that means is that when the universe was 1,000 times smaller, when those photons were released, the temperature was 1,000 times bigger than that. So when they were released, this is the temperature of the CMB today. The temperature of the CMB at release, it was released, those were the photons released by this thermal bath of charged particles that had a temperature of about 3,000 Kelvin. Okay, and there's another very important event that occurs even earlier here, deep in the radiation-dominated epoch. My figure is getting a little bit crowded here. So we went back from today to this is when the CMB happened, matter radiation equality. Now, here we're only a few thousand times smaller than the universe is today. And so in terms of time scale, by the way, the CMB was released when the universe was a few hundred thousand years old. Okay, so a few times 10 to the 5 as opposed to today when it's 10 to the 10 years old. But then if you look back even further to when the universe was, when the scale factor was about a billion times smaller than it is today, and the temperature of the CMB, the temperature of the radiation was about a billion times higher than it is today, roughly speaking. That's another important moment when something took place that we can still observe today, you know, whose imprints we still observe today. So what happened then? Basically at that moment, just like the CMB was the moment when protons and electrons found it favorable to clump together into atoms, this was the moment, this earlier moment was the moment when protons and neutrons found it thermodynamically favorable to clump together into nuclei. So in particular, this is when the lightest elements in the periodic table were formed, and so this is when their cosmic abundances were set. So in particular, if you just calculate with this model, you calculate that, you know, roughly 25% of the universe today should be helium, the second element in the periodic table, roughly 75% should be hydrogen, the lightest element, and then you can calculate trace amounts for the different sort of exotic isotopes of these elements and lithium and beryllium. So those first few elements in the periodic table and their various isotopes, they were produced. Their cosmic abundances were set at this early moment, and you can go out and observe in the universe today. Do the cosmic abundances of those isotopes match the predictions? And the answer, in short, is yes, with a few caveats that hopefully we'll get to when we discuss BBN a little bit more. A few maybe tantalizing hints that there could be some funny business going on, but roughly speaking, this is a big success story, and our sort of best earliest evidence that the Big Bang model is correct. Okay, and then the final thing to add to this picture, the final thing I'll say is just that, as we say, we're accumulating various puzzles about the universe, various things about the universe that cry out for explanation. Why is the universe described by a Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric? In other words, why is it spatially homogeneous? Why is it the same at every point in space at a given time? Why is it the same in every direction? Why is it, in other words, why is it quote-unquote isotropic? We talked about the horizon puzzle last time. We talked about the flatness puzzle this time. There's various puzzles like this that accumulate. Each one of them on their own seems like it could have multiple different answers, I would say. But in any case, there is, as I say, there is a consensus opinion that the best collective explanation, at the moment the best available idea that has something to say about all of those puzzles, is the idea of inflation, which is that at an early epoch here, the energy density stopped going up like 8^-4 and turned over and became flat, basically, roughly flat. It began to behave effectively like vacuum energy again, but at a much higher scale. So the idea is that there is some period where the universe was, the energy density was diluting only very slowly, and the result of that is that the scale factor was growing exponentially. One of the things you showed in the tutorial yesterday, I believe, was that in the case where W is equal to -1, that's a special case where, so in the other cases, A is proportional to T to the 2/3(1+W). But in the case where W is equal to -1, the denominator goes to 0, the actual solution there is that A is proportional to the exponential of HT. It's growing exponentially fast, or in any case, it's almost exponentially. It's accelerating. That acceleration turns out to account for a number of the features, turns out to have something to say about a number of these puzzles, and most convincingly, it turned out to make a prediction for what the primordial density fluctuations, the detailed statistical properties, the primordial density fluctuations in the early universe that grew into galaxies and clusters and stars, and those were very stunningly confirmed over the past 15 years. Again, it's not. I would still call it speculative. I don't think the case is very strong that this is the only thing that could account for the fluctuations and for the for these puzzles. But it's the thing that has made the most successful predictions and is doing the best at the moment. So next time we will do statistical mechanics and thermodynamics in the expanding universe. Actually, most of that will actually be very short because most of that I'm actually planning. I'll just sketch the answers, which we'll need for a subsequent more detailed discussion of the cosmic microwave background and Big Bang nucleosynthesis. But the basic formulae you'll be deriving on the next problem set. So I won't have to spend much time going through that. Yep.
So is this dCMV? The same temperature as the gas in the matter state? So
when, originally it was. Originally they were in thermal equilibrium with one another.
Not anymore?
No, they fell out of thermal equilibrium sometime shortly after this point.
So there are two non-fecal systems in equilibrium, or how should I look at them?
So the photons really are no longer in equilibrium with anything. But nevertheless, they, as we'll see, they have maintained a distribution which looks like it looks exactly the same as the Planck distribution. They've maintained the Planck distribution. Like, it turns out that if you just have a thermal equilibrium, if you have a bunch of photons in thermal equilibrium, so they have this particular characteristic distribution derived by Planck, and then suddenly you decouple them from the thermal bath and just let the universe expand. Well, all of the photons, their wavelengths will stretch, and so their distribution function will change. But it turns out that the only change is equivalent to just it retains the Planck shape. It's just that the temperature stretches to lower and lower frequencies. So the photons are actually essentially completely decoupled from everything in the universe. They just happen to have a thermal distribution with a characteristic temperature today that's only 3 Kelvin. The rest of the matter, you know, life gets more complicated. It's not, I also wouldn't think of the matter. You know, once we get past this point, the action really begins in cosmology. What used to be, up until this point, roughly speaking, the universe was a very homogeneous soup. It was the density, the temperature, all properties, the number densities of all species were all perfectly homogeneous throughout space, up to a part in 100,000. But after this point, structure begins to grow in earnest. So regions that have a little higher density begin to accrete matter from, they have a little bit more gravity, they begin to draw matter in from surrounding regions, and their density gets even bigger and bigger, and the surrounding region's density gets smaller and smaller. And eventually you get, you know, you get in, you begin forming stars and galaxies and things where they, you should really be describing like a star, you know, a star, if there's any notion of thermal equilibrium, it's in thermal equilibrium at some, with itself, it's approximately, you know, it has the temperature of the star, you know, which is huge, much huger than the cosmological temperatures. But that's like a collapsed object. You should think of that as separate, you know, having separated itself off from the rest of the cosmological flow. So objects begin to form and it begins to make more sense to think about the individual objects and what their individual temperatures are than some sort of collective temperature of the matter in the universe. Okay. Oh, I forgot a second joke, but it's too late. It would just be a waste.